Good afternoon, everyone. This is ministering to victims of domestic violence in the church and the community. And we have the coveted after lunch spot for our presentation today. But I'm really excited to be here wearing a different hat than I normally wear for district events and to be talking about my life's work working with survivors of domestic violence. And there are some really fantastic ways that the church and agencies that help domestic violence, like my agency, the Safe House of Southeast Missouri, and survivors can work together. And so I hope that we have a great opportunity to talk about those today. I would love for us to share ideas. And first, we're just going to jump in. And if you don't know me, briefly introduce myself. If you were at Pastor Jason Hill's session earlier, you saw the same photo. Apparently, this is the good photo this year of our family. So, I'm originally from Northeast Missouri. My hometown is Kirksville, and I've been a pastor's wife for 23 years, and have served at Cape Church of the Nazarene since January of 2010. Wonderful blessing to be part of the Cape Church family. I did here on the district previously serve as the district women's retreat director for about 7 years, and I've also been the SDMI secretary, now NDI. I studied communication, public administration, and nonprofit management. I've always had a desire to work in the nonprofit field and to feel like I was making a difference with my work. And so with the Safe House, we moved to Cape in 2010. In 2011, I joined the board of the Safe House and served there for 3 years. And then I joined the staff as development director because we needed to build a new shelter. And it seemed like that was something that I was called to do. So in 2019, we built our new shelter. And it moved into that. We went from a 17-bed facility to a 40-bed facility. In the first year of operation, we more than doubled the number of people that we served. Which goes to show the need that is in all of our communities for services for victims of domestic violence. So I have served as the executive director since March of 2015, and we have had a tremendous growth in our agency. I'll tell you a little bit about the Safe House. It was established in Cape Girardeau in 1991, a grassroots effort of people who cared about survivors and wanted to provide more services. You'll find that most of the DV agencies in our communities are between 20 and 40 years old. There really has not been a movement to serve victims of domestic violence much older than that. And so it's a fairly young area of service. We have three locations. We have our shelter, as I mentioned. We also have an outreach office where we serve non-residential clients. Some of those were in our shelter, transitioned into their own safe housing. Some of them left a domestic violence situation but did have a safe place to go, or perhaps their abuser went to jail or something like that, and so they were able to stay in their home. We provide services to anyone who has experienced domestic violence, sexual violence, dating violence, or stalking. And we provide really, really comprehensive services. They are all free and they are all confidential. So we do crisis intervention. We have a 24-hour hotline and a text line. We do counseling, support groups, court advocacy. So we help people file for orders of protection. We help them file for charges with the police if they want to do that. We accompany them to court for those order of protection hearings and any other court proceedings they might have. We do a lot of case management. We have a transitional housing program. So we have 20 survivors who are in transitional housing. They have been in our shelter or another shelter in our region. And then we coordinate a program of transitional housing where we pay for rent and utilities for a year, which really gives people a great opportunity to get a strong foundation, and that ensures that they'll be more safe and sustainable in the future. We also do batterers intervention because we are trying to end domestic violence in our community, and that means not only breaking the cycle of violence for our victims, but also trying our best to help rehabilitate batterers. And so that is a 26-week court-ordered program. They meet every week. Our program meets at our local police station, and one of our staff members is the facilitator for that. And then we also do prevention education. It's particularly targeted to junior high and high school students. We also do some work with our local college, which is Southeast Missouri State University. And we go and do events like we're doing today. Our booth is set up downstairs with educational information. We're just trying to spread the word not only about the issues surrounding domestic violence, but also the services that we have available. So clients for us come to us from throughout Southeast Missouri and surrounding areas. Our primary counties are Cape, Bollinger, Scott, Perry, and some from like Mississippi County. We work very closely with the other shelters in our area, and I think you'll find that's the case for you as well. Where you live, if our shelter is full, we do our very best to secure a bed at another nearby shelter so that we are sure that people are staying safe. So we are going to talk from the very beginning, what is domestic violence? This is a very textbook answer, but it'll give us a starting place. Domestic violence is a pattern of assaultive and coercive behaviors that perpetrators use against their current or former intimate partners. Domestic violence occurs in intimate relationships where the perpetrator and the victim are currently or previously have been dating, living together, married, or divorced. They may or may not have children in common. Domestic violence is sometimes referred to as intimate partner violence. This is primarily the group that we serve. We do occasionally also serve people who have experienced an abusive relationship in their families. So that could be adult children who are abusing their parents or vice versa. I will tell you that in our case, you will hear me throughout this presentation speak mainly about victims or survivors as being women. That is because about 97% of the people that we serve are women. However, we serve anyone who has experienced any type of abuse. So that means any type of relationship, any type of abuser, whether that would be a male abuser and a female victim. That is, again, our very most common. But we do also serve same-sex relationships and those other type of like family or even like roommate or household type abuse. We will help those folks as well. So you'll hear me use her to refer to our victims, but we do serve anywhere from a dozen to 20 male victims a year as well, many of whom actually do have a female abuser. So there are four main types of abuse that we see, and I am going to actually read these this is our Bible here, and I have some of these on our booth downstairs. It's called Understanding the Nature and Dynamics of Domestic Violence. This is a publication of our state coalition, which is called the Missouri Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Safe House is a member of that, as are virtually every other domestic violence agency in our state. I'm actually a member of their board of directors, and we had a meeting yesterday in Jefferson City. So they do great work for us, and they perform like lobbying and that kind of services, which we're not able to do. And they also do a tremendous amount of training. So the four types of abuse. The first one, and I'm sure the one you think of most often, is physical abuse. So that can include battery, neglect, and endangerment. Scratches, bites, grabs, or spits at a current or former intimate partner. Shakes, shoves, pushes, restrains, or throws her. Twists, slaps, punches, strangles, or burns the victim. Throws objects at her. Subjects her to reckless driving. This happened to us not too long ago. An abuser got control of a woman's car and ran it into a telephone pole on the passenger side in an attempt to harm her. Locks her in or out of the house. We actually have someone in our shelter right now who was locked in the back of a U-Haul and was there for 2 days. Refuses to help when she's sick, injured, or pregnant, or withholds medication or treatment. Withholds food as punishment. Abuses her at mealtimes, which disrupts eating patterns and can result in malnutrition. Abuses her at night, which disrupts sleeping patterns and can result in sleep deprivation. Attacks her with weapons or kills her. We also do assist of survivors of sexual violence and abuse. In our case, that's primarily within a married or dating relationship. When we think about rape where it's a, you know, a stranger who is assaulting someone. We have another agency in our community that is our Rape Crisis Center. You probably have one of those in your communities as well. And they deal with that type of situation where you may not know your assailant and you have to have a sexual assault exam and those kinds of things. There's another agency in our community who does that. But for us, this includes is jealous or angry and assumes she will have sex with anyone, withholds sex and affection as punishment, calls her sexual names, pressures her to have sex when she doesn't want to, insists that his partner dress in a more sexual way than she wants, coerces sex by manipulation or threats, physically forces sex or is sexually violent, coerces her into sexual acts that she is uncomfortable with, inflicts injuries that are sex-specific, or denies the victim contraception or protection against sexually transmitted diseases. That is actually extremely common. Moving on from that, the next most common form of abuse is psychological abuse. This is also sometimes referred to as mental, emotional, verbal abuse. It can also be gaslighting, can be harassment. Very often, an abusive relationship will start out with psychological abuse and escalate to physical abuse. So this includes breaks promises, doesn't follow through on agreements, or doesn't take a fair share of responsibility. Verbally attacks and humiliates his partner in private or in public. Attacks her vulnerabilities, such as her language abilities, educational level, skills as a parent, religious and cultural beliefs, or physical appearance. Plays mind games, such as when he denies requests he has made previously, or when he undercuts her sense of reality. That's gaslighting. Forces her to do degrading things, ignores her feelings, withholds approval or affection as punishment, regularly threatens to leave or tells her to leave, harasses her about affairs he imagines her to be having, stalks her, always claims to be right, is unfaithful after committing to monogamy. And then the last category is economic abuse. So this is when someone controls the money or refuses, either refuses to work or refuses to let the victim work. So controls all the money, doesn't let her work outside the home or sabotages her attempts to work or go to school, refuses to work and makes her support the family or ruins her credit rating. So all of those kinds of things can make someone more dependent and feel like they're not able to leave a situation. Domestic violence is, this is sometimes surprising to people, is not the same type of dynamic as child abuse. And so it's actually not uncommon for a perpetrator to be abusing his partner and not abusing their children. Child abuse is another dynamic, and that is something that child advocacy centers help people with. But one of the main reasons for that is because domestic violence is based on power and control. And it is much easier to have power and control over a child than it is to have that over another adult. So the things that we see for power and control are isolation, damaging relationships, using the children as pawns, sabotaging employment, as we mentioned, attacking property and pets, and stalking. So a word about pets. One of the main reasons that victims tell us that they can't leave the situation is because their pets will be killed. It's a definite threat that is made, and we have unfortunately seen it carried out sometimes. But our agency works with our local Humane Society, and we actually foster people's pets so that they can come into the shelter. Service animals come into the shelter with the people, but if they have other pets, we try to make sure their pets are safe so that they feel like that they can leave. So this is a little hard to see, but this is what we call our power and control wheel. And one of the first things we go over with victims, or sometimes we have people call and they think that they might be in an unhealthy relationship, but they just need to talk it through and verify that what they're thinking is, you know, is really abusive. And this is what we use. And it has those same categories: using intimidation, using emotional abuse, using isolation, denying, minimizing, and blaming, using children, using privilege, using economic abuse, and using coercion and threats. And very often we will have people who are just coming out of a relationship, and they'll say, you know, well, yes, yes, and yes, and yes, and yes. All those things were used against me. So that's a pretty heavy load right there. Very serious things that can be happening inside our homes, in our own communities, and in our churches. I feel confident in saying that that the people gathered here today understand that domestic violence is not right, and it's not okay, and it's never okay. But just to reinforce that, what does the Bible say? I actually found a website that had 100 verses that showed that God does not want violence in our homes. But these are just a few examples. So Romans 12:21, this is my verse for the work that I do and why I feel like it's so important. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. That is what we're here to do every day. Psalm 11:5, the Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. Colossians 3:19, husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh to them. James 1:19-20. Know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. And 1 Peter 3:7. Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. So it's very clear that the Bible supports us in our efforts to end domestic violence and instructs us on how we should behave in our relationships. However, I'm also very, very pleased, for so many reasons, to be part of the Church of the Nazarene, but this is one of them. So this is what our manual says. The Church of the Nazarene Manual Covenant of Christian Conduct. This section is on human sexuality and marriage. And these are excerpts that I put together. Therefore, as the church bears witness to the reality of the beauty and uniqueness of God's holy purposes, we also believe the church should refrain from and advocate against sexual violence in any form, including rape, sexual assault, sexual bullying, hateful speech, marital abuse, incest, sex trafficking, forced marriage, female genital mutilation, bestiality, sexual harassment, and the abuse of minors and other vulnerable populations. Amen. All people and systems that perpetrate sexual violence transgress the command to love and to protect our neighbor. The body of Christ should always be a place of justice, protection, and healing for those who are, who have been, and who continue to be affected by sexual violence. I always knew, you know, that where we stood on this, but when I started doing this presentation and found that, it was wonderfully affirming. And I think that it shows that not only is domestic violence not God's plan for us, but also I feel like it shows that we have a responsibility to do something about it. And so that's what we really want to focus on today. So first I want to talk about how you can individually help a victim, and then I want to talk about how you can help victims in your church, and then victims in your community. So how can you, in a one-on-one way, help a victim of domestic violence? My little graphic here says, start by believing. That is the number one thing you can do. If someone takes the extremely brave step of coming to you and saying, this is what's happening to me, or these are the concerns that I have, the very first thing you can do is start by believing them. You can also, however, if you suspect that something might be going on, if something just does not seem right to you, you can start the conversation. That's awkward and uncomfortable, but it could also save someone's life. So listen to her and acknowledge her experiences, and then help her plan for future safety. Down at our booth, we have some information about safety planning. And that is essentially how to stay safe while you're still in the home. And then at any point, if you choose to leave that situation, how to leave safely. That's an extremely dangerous time for people when they're trying to leave. Because suddenly the power and control that the abuser had over you is being jeopardized. And so that's a time when we see that things can be really dangerous. And so sometimes we will safety plan with people for weeks before they finally actually make the step to leave their situation. We also talk about money, about plans for your to get your like birth certificate, social security card, make sure you have your driver's license. We replace those things on a weekly basis for people who had to flee a situation so quickly that they weren't able to get them. And of course, we also talk about how to stay safe at work, how to keep your children safe at school. And one of the things we work on with the schools is that sometimes if an abuser thinks that their victim is going to leave, they'll go to the school and check the kids out. So that then they have the children as a pawn in that case. So we try to cover every eventuality, but you can help her plan for her future safety. You can respect her autonomy. And what I mean by this is it has to be her choice. So we have concerned friends and family members who call us all the time, our hotline, and say, this person is in an abusive relationship, can you come get them? And our response to that is, can you please put them on the phone? Because we have to talk to them directly. We have to know that it is their choice. And one of the main reasons for that is because if it's not their choice, then leaving them is not going to work. And sometimes it does take several attempts. Sometimes a victim will come in to our shelter and be there for 2 or 3 days, and then they'll think, well, now they miss me, now they know I'm serious, I'll go back. And then you know, actually what oftentimes happens is the abuse escalates as a result of them having left. So sometimes the second time is the time when they're finally able to make a long-term commitment to their safety. Promote her access to community services. We're going to talk quite a bit about working with local domestic violence agencies, but it's very important that you connect them with your local DV agency, not only because there are professionals who are trained in helping people who've had these traumatic experiences, but also it can connect the survivor with other survivors who can provide mutual support and understanding. And then respect and safeguard her confidentiality. It's so very important. This is an extremely private issue. And if you will respect her privacy and confidentiality, there might be an urge to say, put this person on the prayer list or whatever the case might be. But just be sure that that is something that she or he is comfortable with. So we talked a little bit about this, but if this is, again, a one-on-one relationship, this is a friend, a neighbor, a relative, and you want to know, what should I be looking for? These are the things. Have bruises or physical injuries. The most common are black eyes, bruised arms, sprained wrists, and marks on the neck. So I want to particularly point to the marks on the neck. That means somebody is being strangled or choked. The two biggest indications that a domestic violence relationship will be fatal, will end up in the victim dying, are if they are being choked or if there is the presence of a gun in the home. So physically, if someone is being choked or strangled, that is a very dangerous situation and they need to get out immediately. The lethality of that is incredibly high. And then the presence of a gun, a person is 500 times more likely to die in a domestic violence situation if there's a gun in the home. Other warning signs: stops attending church, stops working, becomes reserved and distant, cancels plans and appointments, becomes secretive, receives constant calls and texts from their partner. So that goes into that stalking, controlling, jealous behavior. Doesn't have access to money, as we've mentioned, or doesn't have access to their vehicle or a vehicle. Displays agitation, anxiety, or apprehension. Develops a drug or alcohol problem. Half or more of the people that we serve also have a substance use issue. There's two main reasons for that. One is that the abuser can get the victim hooked on drugs as a means of controlling them. So then they become their source, their dealer, and then they don't leave because of that. The other is that victims use drugs and alcohol as a coping mechanism for their traumatic situation. Changes in sleep habits, loses interest in daily activities, displays low self-esteem, displays symptoms of depression, or talks of self-harm. Obviously, if you have somebody who is expressing suicidal thoughts or ideation, again, a very dangerous situation and something where we need to intervene just as quickly as we can. On the self-esteem, I can tell you that For our clients, the number one requested service that we provide is counseling. And the number one thing that we work on in counseling is self-worth and self-esteem. So abuser works very hard to take those things away from a victim so that they feel dependent and they feel like that they can't change your situation. And it's our job to build that back up. But that's something that you can help them do as well. My page doesn't want to turn. Now, here are, on the other side, the relationship red flags. So these are things that, again, someone you might know might be perpetrating domestic violence, and you might be able to help address that. And I'm sorry, there's so many. So it's a very full list here. So if they abuse alcohol or other drugs, have a history of trouble with the law, get into fights or break and destroy property, if they won't work or go to school, if they abuse their siblings or other family members, children or pets, huge red flag. Put people down, including your family and friends, or call them names excessively if they're always angry at someone or something. If they try to isolate you, which we've mentioned several times now, or control who you see or where you go. Nag you or force you to be sexual when you don't want to. Cheat on you or have lots of partners. Are physically rough with you. Again, push, pull, yank, squeeze, restrain. These things often start small and build. Take your money or take advantage of you in other ways, accuse you of flirting or coming on to others, or accuse you of cheating on them. Jealousy is huge with abusers. Don't listen to you or show interest in your opinions or feelings. Think things always have to be done their way. Ignore you, give you the silent treatment, or hang up on you. Lie to you, don't show up for dates, or maybe even disappear for days. Check out or make lewd comments about others in your presence. Blame all arguments and problems on you. Tell you how to dress or act. Threaten suicide if you break up with them. We hear that so often. I can't leave because he'll kill himself. Experience extreme mood swings. Tell you you're great one minute and rip you apart the next. Tell you to shut up or tell you you're dumb, stupid, fat, or call you a name directly or indirectly. And compare you to former partners or excessively badmouth former partners. So it's a long list, obviously. Somebody might have one or two of these sort of bad habits, but if you begin to see a pattern, if things begin to get worse, if they escalate, or you see several of these, again, these are red flags, meaning maybe you could spot it early, get out of the relationship quickly before things get worse. So now to talk about ministering to victims in the church. So if you have someone attending your church who is in a domestic violence situation, the first thing is to be prepared to serve. So this is the one, I just cannot stress this enough. I know we have several pastors in the room this afternoon. If you will preach the biblical truth and the denominational stance about domestic violence from the pulpit, there is probably no bigger impact you can have than to display to your church congregation that domestic violence is not acceptable in your church or in our congregation or in the Christian faith. So Pastor Jason obviously knows all about this because, you know, he lives with me. But several times over the last 14 years has he talked about that this is not right. And I believe that it was probably during a sermon series in Ephesians where he talked specifically a whole sermon about how this is not right and this is not the way that God designed us to live in our homes and in our marriages. So please take that to heart. That would
must be a good preacher. She remembers your sermon.
I don't remember.
It was very meaningful to me. I was very blessed by that. Know your congregation. Get to know them. Have them over to your house and interact with them on an interpersonal way. Know the signs of abuse, which we've already covered in depth. Know your community resources. So if you had somebody that you needed to be able to refer to services potentially in the middle of the night, you know, who would you call and what would you do? And then develop relationships with your local domestic violence agency and your local law enforcement. It's so important to have good relationships with your local law enforcement as well, for a variety of reasons, but this is one of them. If you have a victim in your church who discloses abuse to you, what can you do? First of all, prioritize the safety of the victim. Does that person need to not go home today? Do you need to make another plan with them for their safety? Or are they okay to go home and make their plans? Again, protect her confidentiality. Help connect or refer her to counseling. So, a note about counseling. I know that many of our pastors are trained to provide pastoral care. Some have further training in counseling. By no means am I saying, you know, do not undertake counseling for somebody who has experienced domestic violence, but I will say that your local domestic violence agency will have for free people who are specifically trained to counsel victims of domestic violence and how to provide trauma-informed care and understand, again, the nature of dynamics of what has been going on. So they can either, if you don't feel comfortable doing that, providing that counseling, you have a resource who can. We pride ourselves in the training and the preparation that our counselors have, but counseling is so important. So however it comes about, it's important to connect with counseling. Again, you can help with emergency housing, transportation, child care. A lot of victims don't have access to a car. A lot of them do have children that suddenly they're going to need to have a plan for. You can accompany her to court. Going to court is extremely intimidating. We have staff who go with people to court, but if they have a friend, somebody who can go with them, it makes such a difference, because a lot of times, see, they'll have left, and then they won't see their abuser until they go to court, and then they have to be in the courtroom with them. It's extremely intimidating. In Cape Girardeau County, we used to have this historic courthouse called the Common Pleas Courthouse, and that's where the adult abuse docket was held. So when you filed for an order of protection, you had to go to the hearing there, and there was nowhere to be except in this tiny little hallway, and it was the most intimidating, terrifying situation for our clients. So thankfully, a couple years ago, they built a new courthouse, and one of the things they put in it is essentially a victim's room. So now our clients can go in their own room. The abuser's not allowed to be in there or come in there, and it makes such a difference. And we actually have way more people who will go through the court process now, knowing that their exposure to the perpetrator will be minimized. So accompanying her to court, going to the police station to make a report is also extremely intimidating. And you can provide support through them. And then again, you can help connect her with a local DV service agency. We also then want to talk about ministering to victims in the community. So here are ways that you can support your local domestic violence shelter. You can, as a church, you can do these things. Collect items on their wish list. I can tell you now, every DV agency needs canned food, hygiene items, cleaning supplies, and paper products. They all need those things all the time. You can provide Christmas gifts. You can adopt a family, oftentimes a mom and kids, or sometimes just a woman who may have never received a Christmas present, and you could provide the first Christmas present that they have gotten. Assembling blessing baskets, so you can collect special items for that can be given for client birthdays, Valentine's Day, Mother's Day, etc. One of the things that we did is we collected like really nice like bath and body type products, like spa type products, that the shelter could keep like on a shelf, and when a mother was having a birthday, the child could go downstairs and select items and bag them up and give their mom a present. It was huge. So that for years at Christmas time, we have collected those items and done that. You can adopt a room in the shelter, so bedding is always extremely welcome, especially pillows, sheets, and blankets. Usually twin and full size is what they have in shelters. and other items. These things, you know, shelter rooms just go through hard use, and these things are always really welcome. You can open up your church to host a support group and, you know, let them use your fellowship hall, yet let them use your children's rooms for child care. You can host a client dinner or a special event for the shelter and provide the use of your facility, and you could prepare the meal and bless them in that way. You can also prepare meals for the shelter and arrange ahead of time to deliver them. You can do that for holidays, or you can just do that for like a Sunday evening, and that's very welcome. You can assist with the maintenance and repair of the facility, and you can also become a trained volunteer. To be a trained volunteer in a Missouri domestic violence shelter is a 48-hour training, but you can do that. And some of it's online through computer-based modules, and then there's some that's like sort of classroom-based, and some that's observation. But most shelters would really welcome trained volunteers who can answer the hotline and interact with clients. So I just want to make a note about this slide. So this is a lot of different ideas, and Cave Church of the Nazarene has done every single one. Every single one of these things. I just sat down and thought about all the things our church had done for the shelter. So every single one of these is possible for you to do. We host a weekly support group every Tuesday night. They meet in our fellowship hall, and their kids use our kids' area and our playground. And we have, that's been going on for, 10 years probably. So, and then they have, we have a client event. In October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and we have a client dinner, and we do sort of a memorial type service for victims of domestic violence who lost their lives. And the church hosts that, which just means they open their facility for us, and then they prepare the meal. And so what so what we eat that night is a prepared meal by the church. So you can do all those things too.
Can I just add to that from from the perspective of a pastor? Like, the great part, at least about working with the SEMO Safe House, is that all of these are fairly, like, you know, confined things. Like, doing an adopt a family for Christmas, it takes 2 or 3 weeks. You bless 3 or 4 families. 5 or 6 or 10 families in the congregation can be involved. It doesn't require a huge long-term commitment. It's just easy to kind of, oh, you need this now, you need this now, you need this now. Developing that relationship with the shelters and the agencies, and you can just do little projects here and there, and they're just easy wins.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, and then the continuing on, I wanted to make a note just about working with your local domestic violence shelter. We oftentimes get requests for somebody to be able to come in and do a Bible study with our clients, or to load them all up and take them to like a Christian women's conference or something like that. Most of your DV agencies are not faith-based, and they are not allowed to do that. That doesn't mean that you can't have Christian influence on the shelter and the ladies who are in it, or the clients, excuse me, who are in it. But there's just certain things that we're really not able to cross that line. But I can tell you that we have Bibles in our shelter, in our library, so they are available if someone would like them. We often have clients who will connect to a church while they are in Cape Girardeau, and the church will pick them up, or like pick their kids up for VBS or something like that. But it kind of has to be client initiated. And so if the client says, you know, back, you know, I used to go to such and such church, I'd like to go again, or, you know, I grew up in this kind of a denomination, I'd like to reconnect, we will do that. We will do that, because we understand that even though we are not a faith-based organization, that a person's faith and being supported in their faith community will really help their mental well-being and their long-term sustainability and all those kinds of things. It's just all positive. And even from a non-faith-based perspective, we acknowledge the value of the local church in the lives of our clients. And so I hate to disappoint people who are like, you know, I just know that I need to go in there and hold a Bible study or something like that with our clients, and unfortunately we just have to say no. But we have had, you know, we will, we hang up flyers. People, churches will send us flyers for their events. Like I said, VBS is always popular. We hang those up, and then if the client says they want to go, we make it happen. So it's a fine line, but I just wanted to make sure that we knew that. But yes, offering rides to church, church activities, VBS is very welcome. It just has to be the client's choice, like everything that we do. The other thing that you can do in your community, as we already mentioned, is to get involved with your local law enforcement. So for us, the way that you enter our shelter is that you go to the police, you call us on our hotline, we hold a bed for you, and then we call the police station and say you're coming. And then you go to the police station and you are escorted to our shelter by the police. So if you don't have a vehicle, you ride in the police car. If you do have a vehicle, they escort you, they follow you, or lead you to the shelter. They'll lead you because they know where it is and you don't. So we work so closely every day with our county sheriff and our local police departments. And they need our support as churches as well. So you can provide meals and gifts of appreciation to your local police station. Our church does a First Friday lunch, and we have taken lunch to our police station. Attend and support community outreach efforts that are hosted by local law enforcement. And you can also serve as chaplains and in other volunteer roles that they have there. So it's that is another way that we're working to keep our community safer. So I also wanted to mention here, I've been talking about what we do in Cape Girardeau, but there is a domestic violence shelter that serves every county of Missouri. Now, it may not be located in your county, but like I mentioned, we serve five counties. And so if you want to know where the closest shelter is to your church, if you don't already know that, this is our state coalition website. It's the Missouri Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, MOCADSV.org. And you click on how to get help, very small print on here. And this Missouri map will pull up. And it's divided into our regions that we use, and you just click on your county or the county you want to know about, and every agency that serves that county will come up. So you can find who serves your local area. As I mentioned, there will be someone. There will be someone you can call and offer assistance to, because we work really hard to make sure that everyone has access who needs it. Okay, so we have about 15 minutes left. I would love to answer any questions that you have. Yes?
In working with shelters and with victims, what would be like your top five things for a pastor not to do or for a church not to do?
Okay, that's excellent. So I'll just tell you. Number one, do not encourage them to go to marriage counseling. I'm sorry to say that, but marriage counseling is for two people who are in a non-abusive relationship but have other issues in their marriage that they want to work through, whatever those may be. I mean, we all know of, you know, things that you might go to marriage counseling for. An abusive relationship is not something to be worked out in marriage counseling. So, by all means, encourage the victim to seek out counseling. You can also encourage the perpetrator, if you feel like there's a willingness on their part to change, to seek out counseling. But marriage counseling can make an abusive situation worse. So don't send him to marriage counseling. the other thing is that we see is that people, they don't start by believing, you know, and it can be difficult if you know both parties, you know, and it's been very well hidden, it's been really secretive, and so, you know, there haven't been outward displays that you've witnessed. It can be very difficult for somebody's natural assumption to be, you know, are you sure? And to, you know, to make them prove it, and to kind of, or to take it a step further and say, you know, well, what did you do to make them mad? You know, what did you do to cause them? No, please don't. Please don't do that. So those two things are the biggest two. Otherwise, I think like betraying somebody's confidence could be very damaging. And And then the failure to help, you know, in terms of, you know, I'll pray for you, and then no further action, no further steps to help them. So I did a lot of research for this presentation, because although I talk about domestic violence all the time, I don't necessarily talk about the church and domestic violence all the time. And I read several articles about people who stayed in their churches as a result of this, or people who left their churches. And the people who stayed, it was because their pastor was supportive. They did have a group of people they felt like they could confide in, whether it was a small group or, you know, a women's group or something like that. And they did feel like that they were listened to and understood. So I think that's the best thing you can do. Yes?
Just to add on a little bit, in my pastor's or my minister's counselor class of college, the first thing our professor taught us was, you're not a counselor, know your role.
Right.
So, like, you know, not becoming a counselor in those situations, but deferring to professionals, mm-hmm. I think has been something that's been very helpful for me to know I'm not capable of fixing that.
Yeah.
But secondly, you said in there, the person has to want help.
Yes.
With that slide, you know the slide I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It's like, that is where it always is.
Yeah, it's so true.
Like, where do we do when we know something's going on, but they won't, we can't do anything?
Yeah, that is the hardest situation. And it's hard for us as well, when we know somebody is in an abusive situation and they won't leave. I can tell you that the average number of times it takes a person to leave before they leave for good is 7 to 8. So now, that could be understanding that it's like you leave the house this morning and you say you're not going to go back, but then you go back at the end of the day. I mean, you know, but technically that was an attempt on your part, an intention on your part to leave. It could be, I go stay with my mother for the weekend and then I go back when the weekend's over. You know, those kinds of things. Or it could be you took the step of coming all the way into a shelter and didn't stay. You went back. Education is really all that we can do in that case, and prayer, I think. You know, we have that tool.
But the pastor needs to be supportive every time.
Yes.
Every time.
100%. And they have to say, this is your decision, and I might not agree with this decision today, but I understand and I'll support you until you're ready to make the decision to change or to leave.
Where does mandatory reporter come in?
That's a great question. Thank you for bringing that up. Adult, healthy adult, healthy is not the right word, non-disabled adults, you are not mandated to report anything about them because they have autonomy. So there are three categories that a pastor has to report on: children, the disabled, and elderly. And if someone does not fall into one of those three protected categories, you cannot report them, because that is their choice, and they have the autonomy in that. So that's why it's important to know about mandated reporting if you are a minister, because you are one of the categories that is mandated to report abuse, but it does not apply to non-disabled adults. Yes?
I read a book recently, and one of the points that the author makes in the book is that quite often people are reluctant to report this kind of thing to authorities, because if I report it to the authorities, all the authorities will do is make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do in a situation where you may be working with someone who doesn't trust the authorities, the police department? Maybe your town or the area in which you live has limited law enforcement resources. What do you do in those situations?
Yeah, or your abuser is a police officer.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
There you go.
We have had that as well. A lot of times, you know, sometimes we encourage people to leave our county, although if the crime happened in, you know, you have to report in the county your crime. So that's when we do a ton of safety planning and do our best to, because then the other thing that we do is we do lots of education with our police officers and law enforcement, so that they don't unintentionally make it worse, you know, by their actions. But we do have people tell us all the time, you know, I don't want to report it, I don't want to file for an order of protection because it will make it worse. And so that's when we're like, okay, well, we need to get you and everything that you and everyone that you care about away from this situation. Make sure you are safe and confidential, and then we will file for the ex parte, the order of protection, or then we'll file the police report or whatever we can do. So, I mean, it is a legitimate concern, because when they get served with that, they will be angry. And so, you know, you have to do what you can to make sure that that doesn't happen. Yes?
So, I already know all this because I'm your daughter. But for other people, like, what particular advice would you give when it comes to, like, teenagers or minors in the church who are going through things like that? Like, how would they minister to people who aren't adults who can just, like, pack up and leave, you know?
That is a great question. So there's a couple of things we can do for teens. First of all, I can tell you that 17-year-olds can come in unaccompanied to a shelter. In a lot of cases, their abuser is not like a dating partner, it is their parents. But you can come in, and we have kids graduate high school from our shelter, go to prom from our shelter every year. So we can do that. But if they're teenagers, so we have a program where we, as I mentioned, we go into junior high and high schools and we talk about dating violence, healthy relationships, and safe dating is really what we talk about. And every year, not every time, but every year, we will have students disclose to us that either they're experiencing it, they know somebody like a classmate who is, or it's happening to their mothers or to their families. And so usually what we do is that if they fall under the threshold of mandated reporting, we go to the school social worker or guidance counselor, and we begin the process of talking about what to do. Because if they're under 17 and they need to leave that situation, then you have a children's division situation where they need to go into like foster care or something like that. But sometimes it hasn't gone to that level. Like there's red flags in their dating relationship, right? And in that case, we can usually talk through that with a teenager and help them plan how to break that off and maybe some safety planning in terms of, you know, I'm not going to go here because I know that's where they're going to be for a while, and I'm going to block their phone number on my text, you know, and on my cell phone, and, you know, some things like that. But we actually, it's very important for us to be in the school so that we can do that kind of thing, because if somebody can learn at that early age what the red flags are and what they want in a relationship, it will serve them down the road. So,
what do you recommend for a pastor when it comes to the courtroom and the court setting, especially if both parties are known by the pastor and involved in the church?
Yeah. I mean, I think that in general, if you have an abuser in your church, then you get into the, you know, the Christian discipline, you know, and I know that process is laid out for pastors, and then it becomes a question of are they willing to change, right, or are they not? There are oftentimes people, victims will tell us, you know, I don't really want to press charges or get an order of protection against them. I just want them to leave me alone. And, you know, a lot of kids, just think about this. This is something we always have to go back to. At one point, you were in love with this person, and maybe you still are, and you thought that they were in love with you, and they said that they were. And so sometimes they don't want them to go to jail, or they don't want their life to be ruined or not be able to get a job and all those kind of things. They just want them to leave them alone. And that is one of the reasons why we don't require a police report or anything like that to get our services, because again, we respect their autonomy and those wishes. So I think if you have a situation where the abuser's in your church and you have done what you can to follow, you know, the protocols that you have as a pastor, and they are not willing to go down that path, and so then you're in a courtroom setting, I mean, I think you show support, as much support as possible for the victim and as much grace as possible for the abuser while maintaining safety. It's a very difficult situation.
Some pastors won't even go to the courthouse because they can't figure out what to do when they get there.
Yeah.
And is that good or bad?
I mean, I think, you know, we stand up for the victim, right? That's always, but it is very difficult. I mean, I acknowledge how difficult it is because there aren't really many other situations where that is going to be the case. You know, if it's a, you know, workplace, probably, you know, not the same workplace. If it's even in a family situation, you know, you have your family and they have theirs. It's difficult in the church, and then it's also, of course, difficult if you share children. There is a certain amount of contact that has to take place, even if you have supervised visitation and supervised exchange and all that kind of stuff. There's still a certain amount of contact you have to have, and there are apps that we use with that. To communicate, it goes into the app, and then it goes from the app to the other person, and the whole thing is recorded in the app so that if anything inappropriate is said or done, it's there. But, you know, we have to take all these precautions. But the church is one situation, and, you know, same with divorce, you know, where it's like, who gets the church in the divorce, right? It's the same type of a situation. It can be very challenging for a minister. Yes?
How do you keep the perpetrator from finding the person?
We have a confidentially located shelter. Our shelter is a secret. Not every shelter is confidentially located, but we feel like it's important for ours to be. So we worked with, you wouldn't believe, we worked with the city and the county. So if you go to the courthouse to look at our property, our name's not on our lot. We worked with Google and MapQuest and everything like that to get our name removed. We've worked with all the phone companies so that our address isn't printed in the phone book. I mean, it takes a lot to maintain that level of anonymity. But even when we built our new shelter, it had a code name. So they waived all of our hearings. So like with planning and zoning. So I mean, they were amazingly cooperative with us. Our local community was so cooperative. But anyway, we work really hard to keep it a secret. We don't park. The clients don't park in a way where you could see their vehicle and be able to identify it. We actually have a church right next door to us. Not our church, but another very nice supportive church. It's a Evangelical United Church of Christ. And they let us use a parking lot of theirs. And then when we have like cabs come, they don't come to our shelter. We have another safe location. You know, we just work at it all the time. The two most challenging ones are work and school. And sometimes we have to change jobs. But there's also more protections in the workplace now than there used to be. There is a law that passed in Missouri in August of 2021 called VESSA, V-E-S-S-A, Victims Employment Safety and Security Act. And there's more protections now at the workplace than there used to be, which is great. And then school. This is not their first rodeo at the schools. So they understand if there have to be alerts on a student's account or, you know, those kinds of things. We go to court and we put custody arrangements together, and so it's very lined out. You know, you can be here and you know, and at this time and this place and that kind of thing. But it's a constant effort. Yes?
If a church wanted to get involved working with their local domestic violence agency but don't know where to start, what's the first step they should take?
Well, in our case, before I was the executive director of our agency, we went and met with the executive director of our local shelter, and we had some ideas, and then we just asked her, "What, you know, how can we help you?" But you could take this list from. I'm happy to send it to you or send you my slides, or I'll just go back to it, and you can take a picture of it. That one, right? You can go in with a list like this and say, you know, are things like this something you'd be interested in us doing? And see what they say. But I would like to be able to promise you, I feel very confident that if you contact your local shelter and say, we just want to help, and these are some ways that we understand you, we might be able to help you, I think you'll find them to be receptive. Yes?
Back to confidentiality, if your church has an active social media, do want to be careful of photographs.
Yes.
Because they're easy to track down, and if your people don't understand, you have a picnic, everybody's taking pictures, and so you have to be aware of that before you post anything.
That's a wonderful point. That's very true. Yes, social media is a whole nother ball game, and the way that people manipulate that to be able to track people or to harass them is pretty extensive. And so, yes, be as careful as you can with someone. We very rarely take photos of our events. Sometimes, maybe we might take the picture of, the back of someone's head or something like that, but very rarely. Usually it's staff or we just, here's our setup before the event or something like that, but we do have to be really careful with that. Thank you. I think we're out of time. But thank you all so much. I appreciate it. Thank you for being here today.